I'm Kara Keehan, and this is Behind the Bench from AJP Heart and Serve. Today, we're talking with Charlotte Usselman, an assistant professor in kinesiology and physical education at McGill University. Charlotte is the first author on an article published on March 3rd, 2020, titled, A Recent History of Preeclampsia is Associated with Elevated Central Pulse Wave Velocity and Muscle Sympathetic Outflow. The paper was the culmination of research that began in the summer of 2016 during her postdoc at the John B. Pierce Laboratory at Yale School of Medicine with PI Nina Stockenfeld. 1 year into the project, Charlotte was offered a position at McGill, which she postponed for 6 months to finish collecting data in a mad dash sprint to the finish at Yale. In 2018, she focused heavily on getting her new lab up and running and, in her own words, badly neglected the preeclampsia research project. But with the help of current grad students, Charlotte finalized the project and submitted her paper, which then went on to be published. Charlotte's story is living proof that things don't always go as planned, much like having a preeclamptic pregnancy itself. And in this point, I speak from experience. Sometimes our lives outside of work are hard, even painful. And this certainly informs how we move forward, both personally and professionally. But a collision of timing can sometimes result in unexpected success. Let's find out more. Jonathan?
Dr. Usselman, it's great to have you on our podcast. Thank you very much for taking the time out of your day to talk with us. Can I call you Charlotte?
Yes, of course.
Great. So, you know, we always like to start off with sort of your elevator pitch on the paper from earlier this year. So real recent paper.
Yes. Preeclampsia is essentially a very dangerous disorder of pregnancy, which actually I did not know a whole lot about, I'll be honest with you, until my first postdoc, which was at the University of Alberta with Craig Steinbach and Margie Davenport. So they run a pregnancy lab there, and it was in that lab that I learned about preeclampsia. And we can chat more about how preeclampsia is dangerous in and of itself, but essentially it's a hypertensive disorder of pregnancy. And one of the, I guess, poorly understood aspects of preeclampsia is the fact that women who have it are predisposed to cardiovascular disease after pregnancy. So we know that they have, for instance, a 4 times greater incidence of heart failure, 2 times greater incidence of stroke. And we don't really understand why. So that's really what we are getting at in this paper. We were targeting gold standard measures of arterial stiffness and sympathetic nervous system activity. So we know in other populations that if your arteries are stiff, you have an increased incidence of cardiovascular disease or increased risk. If your sympathetic nerve activity is high, again, you have an increased cardiovascular risk. So we assessed these things, and essentially we found that both of them were elevated in these women who had had preeclampsia. So we studied them in the 6 to 24 months following pregnancy, and we compared them to women who had recently had a healthy pregnancy. And we found that they were both elevated, but interestingly, they weren't correlated to one another. So central pulse wave velocity, which has to do with aortic stiffness, and is the gold standard measure in humans for aortic stiffness, it was elevated in the women who had had preeclampsia. And sympathetic nerve activity also elevated. And we know that sympathetic nerve activity can sometimes be correlated to arterial stiffness. But in our women, it wasn't. So it was actually, they're really interesting findings, because the way that we interpreted them was to say that these women sort of continued, even though they had had preeclampsia, they were relatively young. They were 34. 34 is extremely young. I say that as a 35-year-old. I always say that to my class and with a threatening look on my face. No one's allowed to call 34-year-olds old. But anyway, so they're pretty young. And young, healthy women have this characteristic ability to offset high sympathetic nerve activity. And it seems like our women, even though they had had preeclampsia and they have this sort of risk factor of higher sympathetic activity, they still possess these healthy blood vessels, these healthy vascular responses that are able to offset that increased sympathetic activity. We did see it at the central arteries. So what we suggested was that you have maybe structural changes at the level of the aorta. And we have some evidence for that because cardiovagal baroreflex sensitivity was lower in the women who had had preeclampsia. And one of the ways that you can have lower baroreflex sensitivity is by having stiffer arteries, especially in the aorta and in the carotid sinus, which means that your baroreceptors, which control baroreflex sensitivity, they are less able to do their job. So that can be accounted for by structural changes. So those things kind of coincide to suggest that there are structural changes there, so that our women with preeclampsia do have some sort of, I guess, warning signs in terms of their cardiovascular health, but they still also have some sort of positive protective effects going on in the periphery. So we speculate that as these women get older and blood vessels get stiffer, which happens in everybody, regardless of your status as a man or a woman or whether you've been pregnant or had preeclampsia, we know that arteries get more stiff with time. So that sort of serves to unmask this high MSNA, muscle sympathetic nerve activity. So that would take a long elevator ride to get through. Sorry, but there's my pitch.
I'm in Chicago. We're at the top of the Willis Tower. Now, so we're set.
Charlotte, this is Liz. I have a question. As you said, independent of sex or age, with age, we will have increased vascular stiffness. So did you look to see if the women that you were sampling 24 months after pregnancy compared to the ones that were at 6 months? Because you said you sampled them between 6 and 24 months after pregnancy. Did you look to see if the ones 24 months after pregnancy would have higher aortic stiffness? The reason I ask is if preeclampsia is truly a high blood pressure disorder, some of the remodeling that you would see on those vessels could be irreversible. So I would think that with time, that remodeling could even get worse.
This is a great question. And now I'm wishing that you had been a reviewer on the paper because I didn't look at that, honestly. Now I wish I had. I will say that we didn't have a huge spread. I think the average month was 15 months postpartum. So, you know, a year and 3 months there, fast math. We didn't get a lot of women who were right around the 6 month postpartum mark. And I'm not sure that we would have had a big enough spread to look at this. Frankly, a lot of the things that I took away from this paper, and this, I guess, is characteristic of science, is that we need more research. This is a really poorly understood population. Like you say, women who are 6 to 24 months could be very different in their aortic remodeling. We also lumped together women who had early and late preeclampsia. So we didn't control for this. We measured when they were induced or when they gave birth. And from that, we know we had some women who had early onset preeclampsia, which is generally accepted to be the more severe form and is thought to be associated with more significant impairments to cardiovascular health later on, but they were lumped together. So essentially, I think there's very good reason for reasons like you said with the aortic stiffness, sort of time post pregnancy, early versus late onset preeclampsia, age, BMI, all that kind of thing, for this to be a really heterogeneous pattern. We collected measures that are difficult to get, especially sympathetic nerve recordings in this kind of a population. But I think there's so much more to do and so many more variables to control for moving forward.
Do you know if anyone is continuing to follow these women? Because you would think that, you know, if they had one pregnancy that was preeclamptic, that they might get it again when they have a second pregnancy. And as you say, it's unfortunately such an understudied disease that it would be really important to continue this type of studies.
As far as I know, there hasn't been one study that has followed the same cohort of women out. And that's really what we need, is to continue to measure these kinds of things in women. You know, there are labs that do repeated sympathetic nerve recordings in women, for instance, but, you know, don't necessarily take a pregnancy history. And so I think the more that we know about women and all of the unique factors that influence cardiovascular health in women, the more we can optimize these sort of longitudinal studies. Because at the end of the day, one of the reasons we don't know a lot about what happens to women who have had preeclampsia is because we really have just a poor understanding in general of the unique cardiovascular control mechanisms in women. Most research, as I'm sure everyone knows, has been done in men sort of historically. And the more we know about women and establishing sort of basic sex differences, I think the next step is to really start controlling for some of these female-specific, you know, life events like pregnancy. So we really can't extrapolate from male data.
So I see that from table one there, that most of these subjects were about 1 year postpartum. Just extrapolating here means they have about a one-year-old at home and they had to abstain from alcohol and caffeine. So no coffee. Did you have any trouble recruiting patients for this study at all?
Surprisingly, no. I would say the preeclamptic population, like most of the populations of women that I've studied over my career, are incredibly eager to participate. One of my colleagues who helped me collect the data shared a story with me that I wasn't aware of a subject. So I had left the room and they were just kind of chatting. And the woman said, you know, thank you so much for doing this research. She said, you know, I love my son, but if I had known what was ahead of me, a preeclamptic pregnancy and everything that's followed after, I don't know that I would have gotten pregnant. And it really affected the student who worked in the lab, who's actually now in medical school. And she wrote about that in her med school essay because it really impacted her and sort of the role that research can play in helping to develop novel interventions for different populations. And I think that women who have had preeclampsia, a lot of them were sort of, and I don't know, Kara, if you even want to weigh in here, that just like blown away at what was happening. Because, you know, lots of people don't know about preeclampsia. I had no idea.
It's pretty intense. And I had not one, but two preeclamptic pregnancies. So the second time around, I was a little prepared for what may lay ahead, but I personally developed HELLP syndrome, which is life-threatening, the hemolysis, elevated liver enzymes, and low platelets. And my younger son, our younger son, was delivered at 26 weeks. So he is a true survivor, and as am I, as it turns out. So It's pretty exciting that you're doing this research.
Well, and that's it. I mean, these women are warriors, you know, and I think that women, especially women who end up with, you know, preeclampsia, HELLP syndrome, PCOS, which is another population that I researched, they have been made in the most sort of like personal way possible, that our understanding of women's cardiovascular control is insufficient. And, you know, they're told by their doctor sort of, we don't know what the best course of action is here. And with preeclampsia, the only solution is delivery. And so the more we understand about how this disease progresses and what may predispose people, you know, can we develop screening techniques? And that was one of our rationales actually in studying women in the postpartum period. Obviously it's not the same as studying someone before they get pregnant, but there is this hypothesis that women who develop preeclampsia had underlying cardiovascular risk factors. So, you know, they go to their doctor, they look perfectly healthy, but there's something there that's sort of like a subclinical cardiovascular dysfunction. And then pregnancy unmasks that, because pregnancy is a huge stressor. I mean, your cardiac output increases by 50%, your blood volume around the same amount. So it's a huge cardiovascular stressor. And just like a stress test that someone would do, you know, in a lab to look for heart problems, pregnancy is a way of saying there, or might be a way of saying there's something here. And so there's sort of this school of thought that what you see following pregnancy in women who have had preeclampsia is not necessarily a result of preeclampsia damaging the blood vessels. It may be, but it may be that there was some sort of, again, subclinical cardiovascular dysfunction before pregnancy.
Charlotte, are you continuing this research in your lab?
Not currently. I am, as Kara said, very new. So currently my research is focusing primarily on young, healthy people and sex differences. And in women with PCOS is sort of the population that I'm getting up and running. I'm sort of trying to focus in on one population at a time. And as I say that, I'll admit that I'm also studying postmenopausal women in another study. However, women with PCOS have an increased incidence of preeclampsia. And one of the things that we want to measure in our postmenopausal women is, like I said before, do a complete pregnancy history. So instead of, you know, if we bring them in and we look at their sympathetic reactivity instead of just saying, you know, whatever, these are the postmenopausal women, here are the similarly aged men, or, you know, these women are on hormonal contraceptives, or whatever our independent variable is, to really do a thorough background and hopefully over time be able to build up enough of a, you know, a database of women to be able to say a history of preeclampsia looks like this once you're postmenopausal.
So the introduction to the podcast, we heard a little bit about your career path, Charlotte, and the way it was stated, it kind of made it sound like a faculty position at McGill kind of fell into your lap, that you were surprised to have obtained a faculty position and that it disrupted your research plans. So how exactly did that occur? Because certainly, you know, one of the things that I found in academia is that you can't really ever plan on timelines very well. I'm sure anybody who's either approaching the end of their PhD or has gotten it has gotten the question from family and parents of, oh, so when do you graduate? And that's a difficult question to answer.
Yeah.
So how exactly did this happen?
I mean, it's funny, when I told people I was applying for jobs or interviewing for jobs, they would say, do you think you're going to get it? And I kept on saying, I have no idea. Everyone that I knew, really, really bright people, you know, when I was a PhD student watching the postdocs in my lab go ahead of me, you know, it's hard to get these academic jobs. And my strategy, if we can call it that, was to sort of just follow my passion and create a niche for myself. And I'm actually really lucky because everyone said what you want to do is create a fundable niche. And I kind of hate that because I think that what makes you a good researcher and a good academic is studying something that you're passionate about. But luckily for me, what I was passionate about was women's cardiovascular health. And I'm really interested in the interactions between sex hormones and cardiovascular health. So that happened to be something that I was passionate about and something that it was and still is very fundable. So I went into these interviews thinking, first of all, thinking, I'm not going to get these jobs. I don't know. They're not going to hire me, so I'll just get some practice. So that was really my mentality, was applying for every job that came up. And I was always told, apply for every job, go to every interview you're offered, because one day your dream job is going to pop up and you don't want that to be the first time you're applying for a job or the first time you're interviewing. So just do everything. And I thought, this is McGill University. There's no way these guys are going to hire me. So there are some imposter syndrome there for sure. But I did remember thinking, if they want someone who has an expertise in the interactions between sex hormones and cardiovascular health in women, there is no one better that they could hire. You know, there are, like, you know, Nisha Charcutian's one of them, Nina Stackenfeld's one of them, but these guys already have jobs and hopefully they're not applying at McGill. And I thought, you know, in terms of the people that I know who are postdocs or who are looking for jobs right now, I had created a unique niche insofar as I could go to those jobs and say, if you want someone that knows about this topic, you should hire me. And so there was, I guess, a little bit of confidence there, but to be perfectly honest, my postdoc funding with Nina was starting, scheduled to run out in about, so I interviewed in March, my funding was going to end at the end of November, and I had started to look at maybe getting into health, working for a city and sort of looking at public health, looking into whether anyone ever needed a PhD there. So really kind of thinking of what my exit strategy from academia would be if I couldn't find a job or a postdoc anywhere.
It's always good to have a plan B. You never know, right? As Jonathan was saying, you can never rely on schedules in academia.
Yeah.
So something that I know it came up the first time you talked with Kara that I thought was really interesting when I read it. You said that, you know, all of us in academia must have a similar experience. It's really hard to start your own lab. And because of that, you published your paper a little bit later than you expected because you were so busy starting your lab that only when you get some students that helped you, you could focus on this publication. Mm-hmm. I actually had the opposite experience. Not that it was easy to start a lab, it was really hard, but my lab, after I started my position, it took more than a year for the lab to actually be ready because they were doing some construction. So I just wrote like crazy for the first year because I could only buy stuff, but I couldn't put it anywhere. And I think it's these little things no one tells you about when you're looking for your first faculty position. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very important for the trainees that are listening to be prepared for the unexpected. So do you want to tell us a little bit about the, I guess, the obstacles or mm-hmm. the difficulties you had on your first year?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was a few things. So I was really lucky in that, this is going to sound funny that I'm saying I'm lucky for this, but we work in a really old building and there's not a lot of room. So they basically said, you're going to have to share a lab with someone. And I ended up getting placed strategically with Dr. Dennis Jensen, who is a cardiorespiratory physiologist. And he had a lot of the sort of base equipment that I would need. So I use a power lab to sort of hook up all of my instruments. And he had a 16-channel power lab there. And that probably doesn't mean anything to a lot of people, but if you know, you know that that's awesome. There was an ultrasound machine that my chair had just purchased through a CFI that I was able to use. So there was a lot of equipment that essentially removed, with my startup, a lot of the obstacles to getting up and running. I would say that I was the biggest obstacle to getting up and running. I would say my research partner for most of my academic life was my dad, which might sound a little crazy, but my dad was a professor. He was a chemistry professor, but he was my hero growing up. He was the reason that I wanted to be a professor. I always just thought that he had the coolest life. To be perfectly honest, he was always my hockey coach. And I remember he would always, you know, take us to away tournaments and stuff like that. And anytime I wanted to call him during the day, he would answer. And I remember thinking, man, whatever job my dad has, he doesn't seem to work very hard. So I want to do what he does. And it was only obviously much later that I realized that that's not usually the, you know, the skinny on academia, but something that my dad worked really hard to do was to be there for his family. But yeah, so I had a really unique situation where, you know, anytime I had a paper rejected or a scholarship application rejected, I would call my dad and we would talk about it. Or if I was having trouble in the lab and getting negative results, or if I had positive results and things were exciting, he was always my first phone call if I got a scholarship or got a grant. So it was nice to be able to share all of those moments with him. And then in 2015, we found out he had colon cancer, and it was a really aggressive cancer. And in March of 2015, he passed away. So that was obviously very difficult. I was in my first postdoc at the time. And then in May of 2015, I found out that I got the postdoc fellowship to go work with Nina at Yale. And I had a good, you know, 30 seconds to minute of being really, really happy and excited, followed by just this crushing sense of, I can't call dad to share this with him. And that is really what sort of defined my first year, because he had always been the one I shared everything with academia wise. And he was my cheerleader. Like I talked about imposter syndrome. Whenever I said, I can't do this, he would say, you know, academia needs people like you. You're going to be a wonderful professor. Like, just you wait and see. And the first year of being a prof, I mean, there's so many firsts. The first time I buy a piece of equipment, even when I walked into my first office, the first time we did a nerve stick in our lab and got a sympathetic nerve recording, the first time I recruited a new grad student, all of those things were incredibly difficult for me, because the amount of times I reached for a phone to call him and had to stop myself, it was really, really hard. I I feel comfortable saying this. Nina Stackenfeld has a rule about no crying at work, but I do not have that rule. So I will say I cried probably every other day for at least the first 6 months. And part of that is because, as you guys know, starting up your own lab is hard anyway. But then I just had this sort of extra emotional part of it where all of the ups and all of the downs really affected me a lot more, until finally one day I ended up realizing that, you know, if I didn't celebrate my victories by myself, nothing was ever going to feel positive again. You know, if I just said, well, I can't share this with dad, this is not as happy as it could have been. I finally thought, what a terrible way to live your life, just not being as happy. So I started to try to find a way to be happy for myself and celebrate with my lab. You know, I have all these grad students who are going through these firsts together, and I can be that person that they can celebrate with and that can tell them they're doing a great job and encourage them. So I think it was when I started getting my first grad students that things really started to turn around. So I started in January. In September, obviously, I had my first grad students. So I had three of them start. One of them was Tessa Adler, who had worked with me at Yale. She did her undergrad at Yale. She came and started with me. And actually, her and Yasmin Kuvadia, who is going to be a new PhD student for me starting in September, they were the two that ended up helping me with the preeclampsia data the following summer and really helped me push it out. So it was them that really helped me to sort of turn that corner between seeing everything as bittersweet and starting to see it as the enjoyable and wonderful experience that it is to run your own lab, start your own research program, you know, start to supervise your own students and really get around that mental block and finally get some data out, which made Nina very happy because she was very sweet and very understanding, but there were a lot of emails and texts saying, Charlotte, where's the paper?
I can't imagine anything that could bring your father as much pride, I suppose, than you following so successfully in his footsteps into academia. I mean, I must imagine.
Yeah. It's one of the things I try to tell myself is, and that was part of me kind of rounding the corner of, this is not what he would want, is sort of me to dim all the lights that are happening. And yeah,
it sounds like he really enjoyed being in academia and
yeah,
would want you to as well. And I think one of the things that I found, and I continue to find most rewarding as a PI is, you know, as you're coming up, you have a lot of mentors who you're like, I couldn't have made it without you. Mm-hmm. To be able to then turn around and to be the cheerleader and the best mentor you can be to your students and trainees, it's so rewarding.
Yeah, it's my favorite part. That's, I now see when Dad would say, you just wait. It's by far my favorite part is watching the students blossom and watching them the first time they come into your office showing you data and being like, I woke up in the middle of the night and I thought about doing this and this and this, and they get so excited. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, absolutely. Most rewarding part of the job. There's no question.
And it's both ways, right? Because you are there for them. Without you, they wouldn't be able to, you know, do their project, finish their PhD. And your lab wouldn't go anywhere without them because it takes a village. On your own, you wouldn't be able to do it either.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very rewarding both ways. And it's very good that you had someone to look up to in academia like your dad. You could follow his footsteps. Many of us, we look at our previous mentors, right? Like in your PhD or your postdoc.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good that you had growing up, knowing that you wanted to go into an academic position, you already had someone that you could model.
Yes.
Fantastic. Well,
and I should also say my PhD mentor, Kevin Shoemaker, was wonderful. I still consider him my academic dad. I don't know if other PIs do that, but Kevin would always call us his academic children. And he gets so excited now and calls our trainees his academic grandchildren, which is adorable. But he's just a wonderful supervisor and taught me a lot about managing people and multiple commitments. And then I was really fortunate to, like I say, work with a couple of really badass, Kara, do you want me to not swear there?
Badass is my favorite compliment. Please do. Please use it. Okay. Are you going to refer to Nina Stackenfeld as a badass?
Yes.
Because she is.
She's such a badass. So I was really fortunate to work with a couple of badass women. And I know my dad was really excited that I was going to get to work with female supervisors because, you know, there are unique challenges to being a woman in academia. I don't have to tell you guys. And that's something that you can't really get, even from the most supportive of male mentors. And you know, my dad and Kevin Shoemaker are both extremely strong feminists, but I just learned a ton from all of my mentors. And I think it's nice because you get to take pieces from all of them. But what I really, really took away from my dad, and the one thing that he really instilled in me, is that, you know, I'm a very emotional person, and I really try to motivate my students and help them to, you know, believe in themselves and really try to tackle that imposter syndrome and create a vibe in the lab that's lovely and that you want to go into work every day because you want to see the people that are there, and productive research follows from that sort of a positive environment. And I think that there's this sort of idea in academia that you need to be buttoned down and get in there and do your work and just like stop talking and, you know, get to your bench or get to your desk and just do your thing. And something that he really instilled in me is that we all have our strengths, and that my strength is really the interpersonal skills. Like, I'm not saying I'm not a good researcher, but I think where I'm above average is I love people, and I think I'm good at getting the most out of people. And having confidence in that and knowing that my supervision style and even my lab organizational style is going to look a little bit different from other people in the department, and that's okay. And especially the fact that it's not sort of a traditional academic attribute, you know, that you're sort of like a warm person. I don't think a lot of that people would look at that and say, oh, you'll be a great PI. But I really got that from him because he was a really warm person too. And he knew how far you could get by supporting the people around you.
I have a burning question for you, Charlotte.
Please.
How did you get the name of your lab? I noticed that on Twitter, your Twitter handle is Char Lab. And I was just wondering, did you name that after yourself?
How dare you, Kara? I would never name either. No, okay, so this was at Experimental Biology, I think 2018. So I just started. And I'll admit it, I was having beers at a bar with Von Macefield, who people who are neurovascular physiologists would know is just the best guy ever.
That must have been a good time.
Yes. Yeah.
Talk about personable.
Oh my God. Just, yeah, another role model in terms of just being who you are. And oh my gosh, the best. So Von Macefield, Mark Badroff, who's currently a postdoc in Toronto, and Chloe Taylor, who works in Australia in the same department as Vaughn. So we were talking about what we wanted to name the lab. And I said, you know, there's a lot of guys who name their lab, you know, like the Usselman lab or whatever. And I was like, you know, I kind of want to do that. Like, I think women don't typically do that kind of thing. I want to name my lab after myself because, you know, I'm a feminist.
Absolutely.
But then I said, yeah, but no one knows how to pronounce Usselman. Then Vaughn said, you know, with Charlotte, you've got some good, I'm not going to do a Vaughn impersonation because his accent is beautiful, but he said, you've got some good letters there. You've got a C, that's cardiovascular. You've got an H, that's hormones. So I think we had come up with cardiovascular, hormones, and autonomic regulation lab. And then I went back to McGill and I told Dennis, the guy who I share the lab with, that I was going to do this. And he was, I think I was texting him, and he sent me a facepalm emoji and he said, oh God, you're going to name the lab after yourself. And I said, yeah, I am. And he's like, oh boy. And he was making fun of me. And then like 5 hours later, I think it was 11 p.m., I just got a text from him that simply read, cardiovascular health and autonomic regulation lab. I burst out laughing. I knew it was driving him crazy that you can't have a comma in your acronym. So Dennis, who thinks it's a little ridiculous that I named my lab after myself, which it is, really came through with the final version. So that's how we came up with it.
That was clutch, Dennis. Very good.
That's a great lab name.
Yeah,
it's a great lab name.
I named my lab after myself too. I don't see anything wrong with that.
See? Another badass.
Yeah, another badass. I love it.
So Charlotte, there was a show on Bravo for a number of years called Inside the Actor's Studio, where James Lipton interviewed a number of famous actors and so forth. And he always ended each episode with these 10 questions that he would ask. I picked out a couple that I thought would be interesting. So I'm going to ask you, what is your favorite sound?
Oh, great question. I think it's the sound of my coffee maker in the morning. You know what? Nothing makes me happier.
What profession other than science would you like to attempt?
I think honestly, and this is something that I've quasi pursued, I think I would like to be a podcast host. And I've got a couple irons in the fire, as it were, so we can stay tuned for that. But I like the idea. I think what you guys do is so beautiful in sharing people's stories. I think a lot of times in life we feel alone and that like the things we're experiencing, no one else understands what we're going through and that there's something, you know, wrong with us. I think that the more we can share our experiences, and that's why I like to be as open as I can, the more you realize that we're all going through these things and we can all do it together. We can all support each other.
Sounds good. When you're ready to announce Charcast, let us know. Advertise it.
Perfect. What are you trying to do? Put us out of business, Charlotte?
All right, and my last question for you, and we're going to have to decide whether or not to utilize any sort of bleeping here, is when your experiment doesn't work, what is your favorite curse word?
Yeah, I'm partial to an F-bomb, I have to say.
Excellent.
If my students were here right now, what they would want me to tell you is that I don't swear. And what happens is I get the silent rage. They say that I'm at my most scary when I get really quiet.
I could see that. I've only known you for an hour. And if you were suddenly quiet, it would make me very nervous.
Yeah.
So my question would be, as an adult, what is the thing that you believe you're really good at it and everyone else disagrees with you?
Oh, that's good. Okay. In my heart, I think that I'm a very, very rational person. I've got my emotional side and my rational side, and I believe with all my heart that I can out-rationalize the emotional side when I need to. Honestly, if you were to probably ask anyone in my life, they would laugh and say that's not quite the case.
So I would like to thank Charlotte Usselman for joining us today. Hearing about Charlotte's journey and path and the research that she has done along the way and has established in her own lab has really given us a great story behind this important research that she's done. And we hope you listeners can join us next time when we hear another story from behind the bench.